we'd like a word.
About the fringes of society, oddities, esoterica. In fact, the person we're going to be talking about today is Dr. David Bramwell, and one of his books is called The Auditorium, which is also the name of a podcast he runs, and maybe this show is a kind of miniature auditorium.
I'm Paul Waters.
And I'm Steve Colgan.
And we're a bit weird, so it all works.
Now, Paul, you're crowdfunding a book.
I am. I'm very excited.
Tell the lovely listener about it.
The many, many listeners.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Well, everyone, it's called Black Watertown, which is the name of a village in Ireland near the border. And it's a dark thriller set in the 1950s. And it tells what happens when a maverick policeman called Jolly Mackin goes to a quiet village and goes looking for a killer. But it might be another cop. And he finds romance. He doesn't know who to trust. He accidentally starts a war. It all kicks off. There's betrayal. You know, are they friends? Are they enemies? It's all very twisted. Frederick Forsyth liked it. So that's Frederick Forsyth, the Frederick Forsyth, the one who wrote The Day of the Jackal.
Yeah, I know.
So he said it was, you know, fascinating story with intricate twists and turns. So if he liked it, it must not be that bad.
Yeah, or you paid him a lot of money.
He has a lot of money, I think.
Actually, yeah, I didn't think that through, did I?
Yeah.
No, so if people want to get hold of a copy,
right,
how
okay.
can they do it?
Well, so it's being published by Unbound, but the way it works is, first of all, they have to think it's good enough, so got over that hurdle, they want to publish it, but I have to prove the market. So pre-orders, and once I get enough pre-orders, it goes into production, you know, copy editing, proofing, printing, cover design. However, so the pre-orders, they call it pledging. So people go to the website and find out about the book. They can read an excerpt. They can see a ridiculous video of me being held at gunpoint. And it was supposed to be a bit alluring too. But anyway, the guns are real.
I just thought it was a normal Saturday night for you.
Yeah, I'll tell you, driving around before we filmed it with the props in my boot was exciting. Anyway, so we got this film. And anyway, you go to it and it tells you how to pledge. And the important thing is everyone who pledges gets their name in the book. And that means your name will be in every copy. And
as a patron of the arts.
That's pretty exciting,
I think.
That's
quite nice considering you're not paying very much more than you'd pay if you went and bought it off the shelf in a shop.
I suppose I should tell you the website. You won't remember the website. But anyway, for what it's worth, the website is unbound.com/books/Blackwatertown.
Fantastic.
Yay, exciting.
It's exciting. I mean, I've been through this crowdfunding thing myself with a few books. And, yeah, it's a bit of a hard slog getting the money in. But once you get there, it's a really nice feeling because there's a real sense of freedom with it. Because
it's going okay. So
yeah.
47%.
That's really
about
good.
About 130 people
that's
are backing
really good.
It. So I'm pretty pleased about that. And we've got some extra rewards like cream tea at Milton's Cottage.
Well, that's quite nice, yeah. Does Milton mind?
Yeah.
Have you told him?
Yeah, he's completely up for it.
That's right.
He spoke to me in a dream and said he'd let me in out of hours. But you've got one going to print.
I have, yes. My latest one is called The Diabolical Club, and it comes out on July the 11th.
Okay, that's exciting. Can I mention some competition winners?
Okay.
So in the first programme, we were talking about Scandi Noir, and is it still Scandi Noir if it's written by a Brit, by Will Dean in particular.
Dean.
And we had his book Red Snow up for grabs. We had two copies, and that was won by Polo in Dublin, and by Mark Vent in Essex.
Oh, good.
And then the next show was by Graham Norton. Well, it was about can celebrities write decent fiction?
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of Graham Norton, yes, indeed, they can. And we had one of his books up for grabs, and that's won by Janice Staines.
Great
so
stuff.
So congratulations, Paulo, Mark, and Janice. So the James Bond book, that's still up
that's
for grabs.
Ah, that's the Anthony Horace one from Russia. That's still up for grabs at the moment.
That's
until
still up for
this
grabs
show's
at the moment.
Gone out, presumably.
Or sometime or another, anyway. You've got a bit of time. And, yeah, so that's cool. Well done.
Fantastic. Well, it's interesting that you were talking about being spoken to in dreams. That kind of leads me into this week's guest interview, because a little while ago, about a week ago by the time this podcast goes out, I was doing a speaking gig down in Folkestone in Kent, and I was sharing the stage with an old friend of mine, a man called Dr. David Bramwell. Now, David is a one-man cottage industry. He's a musician, he's a speaker, he's a writer, he's a radio producer. I mean, the man has got his hat thrown into every ring. I mean, he's an extraordinary character. And the thing I love about David is his whole life is spent chasing interesting stories. He's fascinated with people, as indeed I think all good writers are. And it's led to a series of very interesting books, which we'll be hearing him talk about in a minute. But they're all about the most extraordinary range of characters that he's met along the way on his various adventures. He's also someone who loves discovering arcane knowledge, knowledge that's really quite, I mean, the word esoteric means specialist knowledge that's only shared by a small group of individuals. You know,
it sounds a bit cultish.
Yeah, well, it could be. I mean, he did join a cult for a while, but he talks about that in a minute.
Well, the titles of his books kind of give a hint.
They do, really.
Just,
yeah.
So, The Number 9 Bus to Utopia.
Indeed.
The Haunted Mustache, which is a brilliant title.
It's a wonderful book.
The Odysseum, The Mysterium.
And the Auditorium.
The Auditorium, as in ODD, yeah. Auditorium.
Absolutely. And it's like I said, it's lovely when this information turns up. Now, in preparation for the podcast, I had to listen to some of the shows he's done for Radio 3 and Radio 4 over the years, and also to some podcasts that he's recorded.
Yeah, you'd be so pleased he's finally graduated to Read Like a Word.
I know, absolutely. Well, that's what he said. He said, oh my goodness, I'm going on Read Like a Word. But there's a four-part podcast that he took part in, or he produced and sort of was the sort of showrunner for, all to do with Watling Street. Now, do you know about Watling Street?
A Roman road.
Absolutely. It's one of the oldest roads in Britain, and it runs basically from down near the coast in Kent, and it runs all the way through Canterbury, through London, and on into Wales. Well, he went on a journey with a guy called John Higgs along Watling Street, and they recorded it as a four-part programme. And in, I think, the second or third programme, they end up at Milton Keynes. And you think, what's spiritual or interesting about Milton Keynes? And this is a staggering fact. Did you know that Milton Keynes is a sun temple, a temple to the sun, in exactly the same way that Stonehenge is? Seriously, yeah. The hippie, drippy 1960s planners who first came up with the idea of Milton Keynes, when they were laying out the streets, they didn't take a nice simple north-south alignment or east-west alignment for the streets. They actually set it looking towards the rising sun on the solstice.
Okay.
And the road, the central road that runs through Milton Keynes, is actually called Midsummer Boulevard. And the two either side are called Silbury Boulevard and Avebury Boulevard. And standing stones at Avebury and the Silbury Hill down in the West Country, which are again
see,
big
sun
temples.
See, temples are on my mind because I was just writing about one of my favourite places recently for a website called Chiltern Chatter. And I was talking about Green and Ilock, which is a cashel, a stone hill fort.
Yeah.
In County Donegal, just over the border from
Derry. I thought you were going to say Newgrange or something like that.
Well, but and that's a temple of the sun, they think, as well, as well as being a fortified place. And Newgrange, it's a burial chamber, underground burial chamber.
Extraordinary place.
And at the solstices then, there's a little gap above the door, and the corridor inside, underground, slopes upwards. And so the light, twice a year, the light comes through this small aperture and illuminates a central underground chamber.
It's amazing.
It's eerie.
I've been
and
there.
Weird.
It's amazing. But, you know, how does that measure up to Milton Keynes? I mean, what I did discover is there's actually a pyramid, a thing called the Pyramid of Light, which people now gather at for the solstice in the same way, or maybe not in the same numbers.
Milton Keynes is what they designed the American notes after, isn't it? That little pyramid and the eye in the middle.
Is that what it is?
That's all based on Milton Keynes, isn't it?
Well, now we know. Ooh. Now we know. Yeah, so there you go. I mean, that's the kind of weird and wonderful information that David...
Let's hear a bit of David.
People with him seems to whittle out. But I will say that he started his writing career on a slightly different tack with some books all about Brighton and Oxford.
Let's start with The Cheeky Guide to Brighton. I found an entry here in the What's On section claiming that on the 28th of December, Brightonians celebrate Poseidon's Day, i.e. once a year, 23 Brighton councillors gather on the nudist beach to offer blessings and sacrifices to the venerable sea god, dancing nudity and orgies that go on to the small hours, weather permitting. I mean, how much truth was there in the cheeky guides?
I've always had a strict policy of 83% truth in anything that I write. It's even stated on the back of the Haunted Mustache as an autobiography that it's 83% true. And that began with the cheeky guide. It's not true that the local brothels do student discounts. And it's also not true that the legs at the top of the Duke of York cinema, the striped legs, do the can-can at 3 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon, even though somebody once went and took his family, who were down visiting, to stand in the pouring rain outside the Duke of York's waiting for the legs to do the can-can. That didn't happen. And yeah, I've been in trouble a few times. What's terrific is some of the facts, in inverted commas, that are in the book have been repeated on reputable websites, even Wikipedia. So Wikipedia, I think, quotes us that the large green donut statue, which sits down on the seafront, according to according to the Cheeky Guide, and therefore going into Wikipedia and beyond, that it was a gift from the mayor of Naples in exchange for a large bronze herring, and its official name is Il Grandi Bagel Verdi. which is, I think, is more interesting than the actual truth behind the piece. So the guidebooks came about because I went to Amsterdam in 1999 with my partner then, and we were given a book called A Cool Guide to Amsterdam, written by an American expat living there. And we were tickled by some of the places and people that were included in this guidebook. There was a barge, which this elderly Chinese guy owned, and he had about 60 cats. And the book said, go to the barge. He'll let you on. He'll make you a cup of tea. Do not stroke the white cat, for reasons you'll find out if you attempt to stroke it. Its nickname is Psycho. Around the corner from there, there's a toothbrush museum, the only one in the world. It's quite small, but it's unique. And I liked all this. I liked this, you know, beyond the off the beaten track, away from the Van Gogh Museum and all the kind of obvious things, don't you know, the red light district, blah, blah. I liked that this guy was taking us to meet people and celebrate an eccentricity which I hadn't found before in guidebooks. So when I came back with my partner Alex, we were talking about this, saying, well, there isn't a guidebook to Brighton. There were none. And we spent 3 days just thinking about what word would encapsulate a guidebook for the town. And then the word cheeky just kind of popped out of the ether. And that sort of framed what we were going to do. So the first guidebook had a chapter called Where to Contact the Dead. And we went and reviewed the seances and spiritual churches and the palm readers. By the third issue, we had an occult chapter for the book. And Spotter's Guide to Local Celebrities and Local Eccentrics. We were always careful not to be too specific about, we would never put someone's address in, that wouldn't be kind. But you know, people you might spot on Hove lawns in the past, you know, say, you know, Paul McCartney having a secret joint behind the King Alfred Leisure Centre, away from the prying eyes of his ex-wife now. And it was a lot of fun. We had a lot of fun doing it. And having never written a book, published a book, had any thoughts about doing a guidebook before, I was mainly playing in bands, and that was my main focus at the time, and teaching. And so, as a consequence, myself and Alex and a guy called Jeremy, who we met in a street, created this, you know, this publishing company together. And we didn't know what the rules were. We didn't know what you could and couldn't do. And we managed to get the book out within 4 months and find ourselves having a number one best-selling book locally in Waterstones and some of the other, you know, big bookshops. So, I mean, we didn't know anything about copyright. We didn't know that you couldn't just take images off the internet and put them in your book, whether it was Walt Disney or Star Wars, whatever it was, and that you had to pay for copyright. So we were quite cavalier in our spelling and punctuation, as people were happy to point out later. You know, there were some learning curves. There still are learning curves there. So it was, you know, I learned by doing. And we reached a point in 2002 where we'd done 4 books. We'd done the Oxford book, the Brighton book, Cheeky Guide to Love, Cheeky Guide to Student Life. We had a nice little pile of books, and we were already doing second editions for Brighton and Oxford. And we had a meeting with David North from Macmillan Publishing, and he offered us a £340,000 publishing deal. And we turned it down.
Wow.
And I have never been in that situation, obviously, since. To get a perspective on this, it was for a 15-book deal over 3 years, which meant knocking out 5 books a year, and all of the updates that would have to follow, and finding the writers and managing it. And out of the 3 of us who were running the publishing company, I was the principal writer and probably the principal editor as well. Jeremy was very good at running, being the engine of the company. And Alex, within a few months, had parted company. And so it was a little dysfunctional. And I just had this vision of myself having a complete mental breakdown trying to put 15 books together. We had been approached by 2 guys from Bristol who wanted to do a Bristol cheeky guide. That fell apart. Same happened in Birmingham. That fell apart. And I thought, we can't do this. You know, this money is so appealing. And the thought of setting up this new brand to rival Virgin and Time Out, etc. But I just thought, can't do it. Cannot do this. Similar thing happened with Trans World. We got into a similar situation there. And then I walked away again from that. By now, I was doing the company on my own. And I thought, well, what do I actually want to do? What I'd like to do would be to do two books a year, not do UK cities, which is what those 15 book deals were about. You know, doing Manchester and Bristol and all the rest. But let's do European cities. Let's start with London. Let's do Dublin, maybe. Let's do Edinburgh. Let's do Amsterdam. Do two a year, and then maybe knock out 10 city books. That seemed doable. We were very close. I was very close to signing a deal with Duckworth. And from then on, it became a cottage industry. And I was much happier. I'm glad that that's the way it went. And it opened a door for all the books that were to follow.
Now, it's funny because David writes the sort of books that I used to read a lot when I was growing up in the late 60s and 70s. Did you ever read Daniken, Chariots of the Gods?
Seeing him on TV. This is the Nazca Lines. Looking back on it, I'm amazed that he was alive on television at all.
I know.
It was complete garbage. Hours of documentary.
Oh, I know, and a feature film as well. An actual feature film, I think narrated by James Coburn, if I remember correctly.
It was as if he was a bit like David Attenborough, except for geography and science and the cosmos.
To be honest, it was more like David Icke.
Well, yeah, as it turns out, yes.
Yeah, as it turns out. But, I mean, he sold 70 million copies of that book. But, I mean, I suppose because it was such an interesting and original idea at the time, the idea that all these cave paintings on walls done by Aborigines and by the Maori and people like that could actually be images of spacemen and that the pyramids could have been built by aliens.
Because there were fantastic things that turned out to be true. I'm thinking of the Kon-Tiki Polynesian raft that proved that people might have gone from Pacific Islands to South America, that sort of thing.
But what Thor Heyerdahl proved is that humans are actually phenomenally ingenuitive, and you don't need aliens to build a pyramid. You just need lots and lots and lots of slaves and about 100 years. Mm. You know, I mean, it took was it 30 years, 40 years or something like that to build St. Paul's Cathedral? We kind of lose track of the fact that, they had endless manpower to do these things.
Are we kind of missing that from our lives now? Maybe we don't have enough of that anymore?
What seems to be missing from society these days is stories. In the past, you had fairy tales, didn't you? And a lot of those had warnings built into them. I think Little Red Riding Hood started off as a warning story about two young women to watch out for older predatory men.
Right.
And it gradually migrated and became the Big Bad Wolf.
So we always used to hear, I suppose, Norse legends, Greek legends, Irish legends.
But the modern day myths are kind of what we would now call urban myths. It's things like the gangs of paedophiles that are going to snatch your kids off the street.
Or the Slender Man.
Yeah, and the Slender Man and these sorts of things. Or even, maddest extremes, things like people now believing that the Earth's flat. It's a very curious thing, but there were lots of these books when I was growing up, and even though a lot of them turned out to be arrant nonsense, the point was they opened your mind up a little bit and made you think, wow, what if that was true? I mean, another one I remember very clearly was, I think it was a Lyle Watson, there was one called Supernature, because that was talking about things that do occur in nature but just seem so extraordinary that, it's almost like it's been planned. I remember the one thing I remember really clearly is a story that was in there about oysters gaping at a certain time of day because the oysters kind of knew that the tide was about to turn and food was going to come rushing towards them. But when they moved those oysters inland to like the centre of America, the oysters, over a period of a couple of weeks, started to gape at a later time of day, which is when the tide would have turned if the sea came that far inland. Mm-hmm. And you think, how do oysters know this? It's like secret knowledge. But what they worked out is that oysters could actually feel the pull of the moon's gravity so that they'd know when to gape at the right time. And it was books full of those sorts of stories.
Do you know there are people like that?
Who gape there at certain times of day.
They're just gaping. Some are quite a lot, eyes closed, mouths agape for long periods of time. Yeah. See, I always thought that was catching flies, but it turns out it's the moon.
And there were also lots of books, as I remember, as a kid, about how you could be living a better life. From things like, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, fantastic book, to all these books about, going back to nature and becoming...
We still have that.
There was a lot of spirituality type of stuff. I mean, it's still with us.
So these days it'll be streaming on YouTube.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, it leads me into my next clip, because David... he thought he'd go and look for a better way to live. He went looking for utopia.
Always risky. Utopia. I think utopia is never going to be a destination. You could have a utopian pursuit, a bit like striving for happiness. The pursuit of happiness is happiness, not somewhere that you arrive at, I think. I suppose it's a journey, not a place, I guess. Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. So the the looking for it is okay as long as you don't delude yourself that you're ever going to find it.
Because if Utopia is a place where all your wishes are fulfilled, you've got no worries, you've got no concerns anymore.
Boring.
Absolutely. Boring. Would you want to live there? No, you wouldn't.
You might want to be on the verge of getting there.
Yeah. And it's interesting because if you look at all we're talking about stories and all the stories, you know, going right back to biblical stories, you know, the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden would be nothing without the snake. Because it adds conflict, it adds an element of danger. It adds everything to that story that you need. You've got to have a bad guy, haven't you?
Well, yeah. you're right. You need a snake. You need
Conflict.
You need
don't
grit
you?
In the
you
oyster.
Need conflict for you good conflict. Stories. You've got to have your hero's got to go on a journey, face adversity, and then win at the end of the day.
Like if it was the No Trials of Hercules. Not
absolutely,
much of a story.
Yeah. There's no story, is there? So yeah, David went in search of Utopia, and it took him all around the world to some extraordinary places. He'll tell us about it now.
So the next thing I suppose I ought to ask you about is the number 9 Bus to Utopia, which was the next book. And if you don't mind me saying, it wasn't the best time in your life either, is it? I mean, the whole thing that inspired the number 9 Bus book was you basically having a bit of a traumatic breakup and deciding to go off and, I might say discover yourself, because it's a bit of a cliche, but try and see if there was a better way to live your life.
A better version of me out there as well. Yeah. Yes, I was dumped and replaced by someone my ex described as younger but more mature. And that was cruel but true. Yeah, the book was about a journey that I needed to go on. And there's, you know, there is that whole cliche of men and their projects. And I have been and probably still am one of those people who I love a good project. I love getting my teeth into a subject. I like, you know, the idea of studying Utopia, such a mercurial and difficult idea to wrestle with. That really appealed, as did the idea of going and spending time in different communities around the world, partly because I'd already was always fascinated by different ways of living outside of sort of city life, village life. And also because I knew that it would be good for me. I knew that being confronted with my own kind of selfish attitudes, which had prevailed in that relationship, that I'd learn about sharing and compromise. And I did, and I enjoyed it. And I hope that it changed me for the better. I think it did change me for the better. So it wasn't a glib, for me anyway, it wasn't a glib man project, you know, what happens if I, you know, go travel around the world on the back of an elephant sort of thing. It was a very powerful journey for me, and I had some extraordinary experiences and went to places like Damanhur in Italy, a place which astonishes me still that I can meet someone from Turin, which is literally, you know, half an hour's drive away from the community of Damanhur, and people just down the road don't know that these, you know, this community of now 1,000 people, but once 28 people, have built a cathedral the size of St. Paul's inside a mountain. They did it in secret, and it was revealed to the world in the 90s, and the press just ignored it, and the rest of us just ignored it. And I've been there several times now and so impressed with this community. And it is, you know, it is the eighth wonder of the world. And it also shows what we can do, what people can do when they actually just put their minds to something and have that shared passion and that shared sense of enterprise and endeavor. It really is. So I had some extraordinary experiences. I mean, people say, oh, did you go to communities which were run by Svengali types and, you know, and kind of charismatic leaders? And the answer was no, I didn't, not really. The chap who set up, Falco was his kind of name within the community, who set up Damanhur. The first time I ever met him, I thought, oh, he looks like he probably used to lecture in systems analysis at some Reading Polytechnic, you know, just this drab guy in a bad cardigan. And I thought, yeah, he doesn't really look like the classic charismatic leader with his chest out and mane of hair. I was quite, you know, quite impressed with his, you know, how unimpressive he was. So I think that book was a real defining point for me as a writer, in that I found that what I loved about writing guidebooks was the opportunity to have this bird's eye view of the place you live in, I suppose, you know, to consider what it is to live in a city and be engaged with the gay scene, the music scene, the, you know, the new age scene, the dance scene, et cetera, and go and experience all of those things. And then to consider community life, different ways of living, the ways that people have found to explore alternatives to what we're sold in Western society. So I think I realised that there's a fascination for the other. There's a fascination for subculture and different ways of looking at things, which has continued ever since then.
I mean, the one thing that strikes me, I mean, having read one of the Cheeky Guys to Brighton, one of the editions, and having read the number 9 Bus to Utopia, which was one of my favourite books that year, was that they're both very positive. At a time when there was a slew of TV shows about grumpy old men and terrible seaside towns, and it's still going. I mean, you go through the planner on the telly and it's programmes called, you know, Sinister Ministers, Wives with Knives, Fear Thy Neighbour, and everything's very negative. And the one thing that struck me is, you know, even though these utopian societies you were visiting, or they believe they were trying to find a utopia, it was still very positive. It was very uplifting. They truly believed in what they were doing, and they were happy, weren't they? I mean, that's the thing. They were happy.
They were a damn sight happier than I think those of us living city lives, etc. I think because there is a shared purpose, a shared sense of purpose and meaning, investing in meaning. So we live in quite a nihilistic culture in terms of having stripped away meaning. And I'm a big fan of Joseph Campbell, the writer in the 20th century who dedicated himself to studying mythology. And Campbell said, in the 20th century, we've dismantled many of our established myths because they no longer serve us, and quite rightly so. You know, he's talking about the myths of empire and patriarchy and Christianity, etc. But Campbell ended with a caveat and said, what the world desperately needs right now are new myths to live by, and that's where I think where we failed. We've failed to create, or maybe it's changing now, but I think we've done a terrible job of trying to look for the positive in things and actually reveling in the more cynical perspectives. And I, for whatever reason, I don't know why, but I seem to have a sort of a positive, optimistic demeanour despite growing up in Scunthorpe, Doncaster and Coventry. And so I've always been niggled by that presence of particularly men in the media, particularly privileged men, who seem to spend most of their time griping and complaining and telling us, you know, where we've all gone wrong. And I remember seeing Stephen Fry on Room 101 put Room 101 in Room 101. And I thought, I like that, that's very good. And he was saying that, he was saying, you know, same thing, he was finding too much cynicism in the media. And that was a catalyst for me to set up a night called the Catalyst Club in Brighton, which has been running for 15 years, which is a night where people are invited not to come and say, talk about the three things that they really hate, but actually talk about a passion, talk about something they love.
The Catalyst Club has had some fantastic talks, hasn't it? I mean, a lot of them have actually been redone on the Auditorium podcast too. But I mean, look at some of the subjects. Demonology for Dummies, The Eating Habits of Politicians, and two of my personal favourites, Werewolf Erotica and My BDSM Relationship with the Archers.
We had a best of recently, and that was three topics which I think sort of epitomised the Catalyst Club, really. We had Ron Geeson, best known for working with Pink Floyd in the early 70s, but his particular passion is adjustable spanners. He's even written a book about it. So he came and showed 30 slides of different spanners that particularly interest him. And then we had Lynn Murphy from Sussex University talking about language, the difference between American and English language. She does a controversial talk called How the Americans Saved the British Language. Yes. And it's brilliant. It's very funny. And you know, she knows her stuff. And then we had Sachi Kumari, who is a Japanese performance artist, who is also a bum reader or rumpologist, one of only three in the world. The world's leading rumpologist is Jackie Stallone, Sylvester Stallone's mother, who charges, I think, $600 a reading. And they read the bottom like a palm reader reads the palm, although Saatchi won't insist on you being naked. She's happy to read your fortune through tight trousers. She can tell through the creases and the shape. And that, to me, was a classic Catalyst Club. That's the kind of stuff that we do. Because it's Brighton, it's never going to be regular people, regular talks. No. It just isn't.
Now, I've got to come back to Geeson for a minute, because very much in the news has been the fact that Jacob Rees-Mogg, his book on the Victorians, didn't do terribly well. in the bookshops, sold 730-something copies. Yeah. And someone I saw on Twitter put up that Giessen's book on adjustable spanners had sold more. That's right, isn't it?
It is right, and that's exactly how it should be. And by a strange coincidence, one of my many jobs outside of writing, because let's face it, we all have other jobs, is doing some freelance work for Penguin. And I sometimes get last-minute calls to produce audiobooks. And I had the call 3 weeks ago, I think it was. And they said, I'd just done a book on breast cancer and a little book of Calm. And they said, would you come in and do a book on the Victorians by Jacob Rees-Mogg? So I found myself alone in a room with the man for 3 days straight. And that was interesting. And it's interesting the different responses you get. I was on a writing retreat at the time when I got the call. And my friend Hillary, who's a retired psychiatrist who used to work with people in very secure units in prisons with severe mental health problems, I told her, and she went, "Ooh, how fascinating. I would love to spend 3 days." And my girlfriend just went, "Ugh." And I thought, you know what? If you could spend 3 days with Luke Skywalker or Darth Vader, who would you choose? You'd choose Darth Vader, wouldn't you? Much more interesting. So I found it very curious. And I was sort of expecting he'd have a minder or something, but actually it was just Anyway, he was very polite and very reserved, and I had to sit through quite a few hours of that book. It was very odd. He was quite obsessed with his Facebook page, his supporters' Facebook page, and doesn't appear to eat anything. And I noticed that he didn't cast a shadow either. Yeah. But the curious thing is, to bring this full circle, what do you chit-chat about in those breaks when he's done too much and we need to get him out of the room and just give him sort of 10-15 minutes to recover? We're not going to talk about politics. That would be stupid. So one of the days I had to leave early to go to the Catalyst Club, and he said, why are you leaving, David? Why can't you stay? I said, I run this event where people come and talk about their passions. And he said, oh, that sounds very interesting. What kind of things do you do? I said, actually, we've got coming up, we've got a talk on the ivory-billed woodpecker, last seen in 1945 in an American swamp. And, we've got Ron Giessen coming to talk about adjustable spanners. And I never imagined that those two... would go, yeah. So we had a little conversation about that. So, and then by coincidence, that book was referenced in that Twitter feed about Ron selling more, as you say, than Jacob's.
So how about that for a bizarre We'd Like a Word exclusive?
Amazing. Jacob Rees-Mogg on We'd Like a Word. I thought there was one place, if there was one place you'd be safe from him, it's here. But of course, then he blinking.
No, it was just extraordinary that in the week when the whole story broke about him not selling as many copies as he thought he would, and the fact that the book about the spanners had beaten him, that David had that connection with both people. Absolutely extraordinary.
He hasn't been having the best of years, Jacob.
He's not.
But he maintains his polite demeanour.
He does.
Throughout.
He does. And we don't talk politics on this show, do we?
No, we don't.
It's not a political show.
I've been to one of those utopian places.
Oh, which one?
Christiana, which is in Copenhagen.
Oh, the one in Copenhagen, yeah.
In Denmark. And it was a pretty nice place. It was an old naval base, I think.
Yeah.
Or area that had been a naval base. And they occupied it kind of in an anarchist way. And it's kind of a lot of people sitting around in the sun having a smoke. And... kind of relaxed and quiet, no traffic, no motorised traffic in it, I think. Mm-hmm. People with those, like bicycles with great big boxes on the front.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Children or cabbages or whatever it is in it. So that was a pretty nice place.
David talks a lot about the architecture and how fascinating it is in Christiania, because they basically just built their own houses in there, and everyone expected they just nail some crates together or live in a cardboard box, but they built some beautiful houses, haven't they? Really extraordinary. Almost like Hobbit-like architecture, some of it. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it was nice on a sunny day. I liked it anyway. And, actually, Polo, who I mentioned at the start of the programme about...
the prize winner.
A prize-winning Polo. Yeah. He entered in the Will Dean episode, but he sent in a comment on the Graham Norton episode. This is the listener we like who listens to more than one episode.
Someone who leaves us comments?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, and one of the things, we're talking about celebrities you know, can they write good books? And then we were talking about, first of all, they may not write them, their own books, and do they even read their own books? And he was saying, there's a guy called Brendan Grace, I don't know if you've heard of him, he's an Irish comedian and singer, and he had a schoolboy character called Butler, and he was in Father Ted, he was Father Fintan Stack.
One of my favourite characters, right. And one of my favourite episodes.
Well, that's Brendan yeah. Grace.
Love it.
So
love
you
it,
know
love
that
it,
song, Combine Harvester? So that was the number one for the Wurzels. That was, he did it, Brendan Grace.
He did it first.
It was number one in Ireland the year yeah. before. So Paulo says, you know, I know you were doing fiction on that show, we were doing fiction, but your remarks brought to mind Brendan Grace's Butler autobiography. It was called Amusing Grace. And he's from the same part of Dublin as Paulo, Eklund Street, James's Street area. And he says, it's an autobiography, but it was quite a disappointing saga in name-dropping. But the particular reason he mentions it is because we were referring to, he says, a lady who didn't even read her own book. I think that was Naomi Campbell. He says, yeah. there's a character in Brendan Grace's book called Mick Sereed. And Paula was thinking, God, it definitely rings a bell. I should know him. But he couldn't work it out. Eventually, it dawned on him. It was actually Mixer Reed. So presumably, Brendan Grace had been dictating this and somebody had written it down as Mick, short for Michael, and then a surname, Sir Reed. But it was actually Mixer. How you doing, Mixer? Mixer Reed. It was a wee guy who was a comedy star in the Theatre Royal. And he's saying, Brendan's slip is showing here, not properly reading his ghostwritten
manuscript. Yes, absolutely.
Before it went to press. Sad.
Oh, yeah. But he can be forgiven because that episode of Father Ted is one of my
yeah.
favourites.
Anyway, he was absolute in Father favorites. Ted, so that's excellent. Right, weird yeah. stuff, right? One of the my favourite weird things is Oliver Plunkett's head. Have you ever seen it?
No.
Oliver Plunkett's head, right.
Do you have to explain who Oliver Plunkett is?
He was a bishop, an archbishop in Ireland in the 1600s. And they had rules against promoting Catholicism. So he was a Catholic archbishop. So he was, arrested and tried and found guilty of high treason. So I mean, he got hanged, drawn and quartered. But it was all right because he got made a saint, you know, a few hundred years later. But anyway, so his head was cut off and his head moved around various places. But it ended up in Drogheda in 1929. And it's still there. His head is in a glass box. It's not a skull. It's his head. It's not even a shrunk. It's a slightly shrunken head.
Well, it will. Yeah, it looks
it's shrunk a bit. But it's like a face. It's a head in a glass box in this church, and they've got some of his bones as well. Imagine you think, oh, we'll just go down to the church. Oh, what's in that glass box, Mummy? It's a severed head. Oh, that's Oliver Plunkett's head. How weird is that? Obviously, I took my children to see it when I first brought them to Ireland. Oh, essential stop. See severed head
absolutely,
in a church.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just having to think of all the sort of weird and wonderful books I used to read. I mean, there's a guy called Rupert Sheldrake. Have you come across him?
I have.
He's written some very interesting books. Now, he's a bit shunned by the mainstream scientific community because some of his ideas are a little bit on the edge. Like one of his most famous is the idea of morphic resonance, the idea that all creatures within a single species are somehow connected. I mean, the examples he gives is that back in the 1960s, when blue tits started pecking the foil on the top of milk bottles, and within weeks every blue tit in the UK was doing it. And there's another story he tells about how sheep in Wales learned to roll over cattle grids to get out of the fields, and within a very short time sheep in Australia were doing the same thing, even though obviously sheep didn't phone each other saying, hey, cousin Pat over there in Australia, guess what we've learned to do. See, I didn't do the Welsh accent because I can't, but yeah, it's also known as the 100th monkey effect. Uh-huh. And it was mentioned by Lyle Watson, I think, right back in the Supernature books back in the 70s, the idea that a number of monkeys started washing their food in the salt water, in the tidal water. And as a result, not only did it get all the grit off, but the food tasted better because it was slightly salted. Uh-huh. And within a very short period of time, every single monkey was doing exactly the same thing. So he's got some extraordinary ideas. He wrote a whole book on the idea that dogs know when their owners are coming home. I should say also, by the way, that the number 9 bus to Utopia, the book that David was just talking about, where he went around to all these different communities.
Our competition prize.
We do have that. We do have a signed copy of that as our competition prize this episode.
Yeah.
Now, we've just got to set a question for the listeners, haven't we?
I think a good question is something that gets to the real bottom of everything.
Uh-huh.
We're talking about reading bottoms.
Oh, Jackie Stallone, who's an expert bottom reader. Yes.
Bottom reader. And I think we'd say, What is the official term or the proper term for someone who reads bottoms?
A correct name for a bum reader.
A correct name for a bum reader.
David did mention it, didn't he, in his little interview?
So if you listened or you listen back, you'll know the answer. So what's the official term for a bum reader?
So how do people send us their competition entries?
Oh, yeah. Our email, wedlikeaword@gmail.com. And of course, I have to point out, there's no apostrophe, so it's wedlikeaword. Okay,
wedlikeaword@gmail.com.
Good.
Okay, well, I should also say that the number 9 Bus to Utopia was crowdfunded through Unbound in the same way that your book currently is.
Well.
So, because David's tried various things. He was, I said, his first Cheeky Guides he self-published, and then this was crowdfunded. For his next book, he had took a more traditional route where he was actually published by an established publisher. But his next book was called The Haunted Moustache. I think it's probably my favourite out of all of his books.
It's a fantastic
title. It's an amazing story, but here's David to tell you a bit more about it.
The Haunted Moustache is a story about a family heirloom. It's the moustache of a Victorian freak show host, which was given to me by my great-aunt Sylvia, or left to me by my great-aunt Sylvia in 1991. She died. She didn't quite make it to 100, but she lived her whole life in the village of Woodall Spa in Lincolnshire, and was involved with seances and spirituality and all the rest of it, and had lots of strange knickknacks in her house. And this was one of her many strange artifacts. And I didn't know at the time. I didn't know it was pre-internet age. I didn't know who it belonged to, where it had come from, why she'd left it to me. It also had this strange medallion with these words "trust, absolute and unconditional" etched into them, and it set me off on a 10-year odyssey to try and find out what the hell it was, where it had come from, who this man had been, who I found out his name was Ambrose Oddfellow. And how my Aunt Sylvia ended up with the moustache in the first place. So I moved to Brighton shortly after inheriting it and got in a relationship with someone who was quite into all of the, you know, the idea of the afterlife and communicating with the dead. So I, you know, and I was falling in love and I was 21. And so I started visiting seances and spiritual churches. And then, you know, before you know it, as you do, I joined a cult for 2 years. I ended up hosting a modern day freak show in Brighton, which culminated in me doing a striptease on stage and slipping over in somebody else's. And starting to drink ayahuasca, a Colombian psychedelic plant, which gives the certainly the feeling of telepathy, the experience of telepathy. I journeyed to the far reaches of the universe on that stuff. And all in the name of trying to find out, you know, what this thing was, and, you know, who this man Ambrose Oddfellows was and why I'd ended up with it, which I kind of did. I sort of, there's a resolution in this. The Haunted Moustache book ends with me telling the story, as you know, of how the band got its name. Oddfellows Casino is a band I've had for 18 years now, and it was the name of the freak show that Ambrose Oddfellow ran for many years at the turn of the last century. And I'd like to think that there is a Guinness World Record out there for the longest explanation of how a band got its name. because that's what the book is. Yeah. Ultimately, the book is, how did your band get its name? Well, how long have you got? I inherited moustache, ...
And that brings me on really to your trilogy of books, which is the Auditorium, the Mysterium, and the Odysseum. So just for the listener's benefit, what's the basic idea of the three books?
Well, they're all compendiums. The first one was about curious people, individuals, real individuals who change the way that we think. Most of them for good, and a couple of them in the book for bad. And I got to write about people like Sun Ra and Stanley Unwin and Moondog.
And T. Lobsang Rampa.
Well, yes. He'll always be
an amazing character.
He will remain a hero of mine. So for those who don't know, he wrote a book in 1956 called The Third Eye, which was an autobiographical account of growing up in Lhasa and being sent to a lamasery to learn the arcane arts of Zen Buddhism, mysticism, and had the third eye physically drilled into his forehead at the age of 8. He writes about meeting yetis and doing yogic flying. And the book sold 2 million, I think, 2 million copies. And now, see, not many people had been to Tibet back in 1956, but those that had thought, you know, maybe less than 83% truth in this one. Heinrich Harrer, who is best known as being the character who 7 years in Tibet was about, hired a private detective who discovered that Dr. Chuzzi Lobsang Rampa was in fact one Cyril Hoskin from Devon, an unemployed plumber who'd put his back out falling out of a tree whilst owl-spotting and reinvented himself as a Tibetan Lama, which is genius. And he wrote another 17 books. He even used to sell, at the back of his book, he used to sell Rampa stones. And I tried to buy one recently, and they were, from what I could gather, they were just pumice stones in which he or someone had just carved the word Rampa. Not very well by the look of it either, but they were imbued with magical powers, apparently. So, oh, bless him. And he did an album of meditation in his strong West Country accent, and I've got a copy of that as well. So he's a hero. So the book, so Auditorium was, it covered rogues, rascals, tricksters, and you know, people who really changed culture, changed the way that we think about things. The Mysterium was an opportunity to go back to those books which Joe and I, so these were all co-written with my writing partner, Joe Tinsley, and we were both obsessed with Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World and the Reader's Digest, you know, Book of the Unknown and all this from the 80s, and thought, you know, where are those books now? And have any of those stories stood the test of time? And the answer is no, not one of them. When you go back and look at those books, they're all based on either anecdotal evidence or dodgy photos. Oh, and of course, okay. And nowadays you can't get away with that. You could then, pre-internet, you could get away with it, pre-mobile phone. But now you can't. So we go back and we look at Nessie, spontaneous combustion, your crop circles, UFOs, all that stuff, and go, oh, we've got to start from scratch here. But the book was great fun, really interesting to find out what those new stories were. And it meant delving into the internet, not delving into the internet in terms of websites telling you about weird shit, but actually the internet itself and, you know, the role that the internet has played in allowing anonymity. So someone like Satoshi Nakamoto, what's the name? I can't remember. But the name that is associated with the creator of Bitcoin. We don't know who created Bitcoin. Yeah. There is a niche erotic fiction author called Chuck Tingle who has published 50 or 60 books now. Nobody knows who Chuck Tingle is. So much easier to be anonymous. It's love between man and either A, extinct animals, B, fictional animals like unicorns, C, inanimate objects like coffee cups, or D, concepts like linear time. But there's some quite dark stuff in there. I realise that a lot of mysteries nowadays really are to do with the mystery of consciousness and the weird things that we do. The darkest story, I think, was human feet keep washing up on a beach in British Columbia. The Salish Sea Mystery, And it's very weird. It's probably 18 feet so far. But one of the most fascinating for me was the story of the Hmong men. This to me is a story that says so much about the real mystery of consciousness. In 1979, there was a coup in Laos, and the Americans had been funding a certain guerrilla group, and it all backfired, and the communists took over. So the Americans said, you know, you're going to be killed if you remain in this country. We will allow you to come and relocate in America. And these men were from different backgrounds, different groups, different cultures within Laos, and one of them were called the Hmong, from a shamanic traditional background. And where the shaman plays a powerful role within this community. These men came over in their hundreds and their thousands. The Hmong began to die in their sleep, first in small numbers and then in large numbers. And these were perfectly healthy men. There was one group of men, 117, came together on a boat. Every single one of them is dead within 6 months, bar one. One survived. And the doctors in America could not work out what was going on because they were doing autopsies and saying, these are perfectly healthy men. They are between 25, 35, 40. They should not be dropping dead in their sleep. We don't know what's going on. So they created an acronym, Sudden Unexpected Nocturnal Death Syndrome. SUNDS is what they called it. For 25 years, this case was studied by someone called Dr. Shelley Adler. And she came to the conclusion they had scared themselves to death. It doesn't hold true. It doesn't hold together, this story, because the Hmong said, we know what's killing our men. The Dab Zog is killing our men. This is the night hag. She will come to you at night. She'll creep out of her cave and she'll sit on your chest and try and paralyze you. If she starts to do that, you need to get to the shaman quickly and the shaman will exorcise her from you. You know, there'll be some rituals, etc., take place. These men were dislocated. They couldn't access the shaman. They were experiencing culture shock. And on top of that, they were having visitations from the Dab Zog. So the Western perspective is they scared themselves to death. But it begs the question, how do you scare yourself to death in your sleep? They were dying in their sleep. The Hmong said it was the Dabsog who killed them ultimately. And we say it was nocebo. It was the nocebo effect that was killing them. And neither of those stories, they're so different. And yet none, you know, you can't look at either of us and go, well, I believe that or I believe that. They don't add up. I found that fascinating and terrible. So those are some of the stories for Mysterium. And Odysseum, the last one that came out, is a book of unusual journeys. And I really, really enjoyed researching this one. The pieces are much longer within this book. One of the stories was about how Albert Speer, one of the gang of Nazis who spent 20 years of his life in Spandau, had decided to walk around the world to give him something to do, to occupy his mind while he was there. And it was the consequence of Rudolf Hess giving him 30 dried peas to put in his pocket and said, I've noticed that you're walking around our little makeshift garden that they've been working on. He said, if you exchange a pea from one pocket to the other, every time you do a lap, we'll measure what a lap is, and you can work out, you know, how far you're walking each time. So he does that, and he gets quite into it. He decides that he'd like to walk home. So he calculates how many laps he'd need to do to walk home, uses the peas to kind of help keep count, and walks back to his home. And then he decides that he was an ambitious man. So he decided to walk the world. And he walked, I think, 31,000 kilometres. And he mapped it all out. And he got guidebooks and maps from the prison library. And he worked out where he was going to go. And he tried to avoid all the communist countries, because they're the bad guys, aren't they? So, you know, he avoided all of these places to make it an even more long-winded journey.
But did he have a cheeky guide to Brighton?
He could have done with a cheeky guide. But there are times when you're reading his diaries, there are times when you have to remember that this man is fictionalizing this. You know, he's talking about walking through the tundra, talking about seeing Arctic foxes as he's heading towards the Bering Straits and then crossing over into America. He ends up in Mexico when he finally is let out. And I contrasted his journey with Xavier de Maistre, who wrote A Journey Around My Room, who was confined for only 6 weeks for an illegal duel in the early part of the 19th century, I think. And so he decided to make a journey around his room, going from his chair to his desk, have a look at the pictures on the wall, write about his bed for 30, 40 pages. And it's full of delight and mischief and sort of endless fascination, which you can have if you have the right kind of mindset of, if you're trapped in a room for six weeks, what are you going to do? Look at everything and really look at it, write a book about it. And I sort of compare and contrast the two of them. And what was curious was that both admitted after being released that they were still dreaming about being back in their confined spaces and in some ways sort of missing it.
Weird stuff.
People are really interesting, aren't they?
I'm going to tell you about an interesting guy I met. But first, I've got a trail for another podcast. So this is a new thing. We're cross-trailing for another podcast. And this one that I'm going to tell you about is called Essentially Genuine Chit-Chat. So it has one out of three things in common with us. It has a different guest in every episode: musician, writer, business owner, podcaster, scientist, filmmaker, or somebody with mental or physical health issues. Generally interesting people. And the presenter, Mike, talks about politics, society, movies, comedy, podcasting, science, sex, travelling, genuine conversations, serious or funny, passionate, informal, and uncensored. That's the Essentially Genuine Chit Chat podcast.
Like the sound of it. People are interesting. Yeah, you've been saying it all along.
People are interesting. And right, so this guy I met, I'm going to pronounce his name wrongly, but he's called Sibusiso Linda Mbeli. So I met him in the northwest corner of KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa. It's just near the border with Lesotho. Mm-hmm. And the thing about him is he built a plane. He built a plane and he lives inside the plane. And he's built the plane out of bits of old scrap metal, like fuel canisters that he's beaten flat, or bits of van.
Right.
So the doors into the plane are van doors. And it sits off the ground. You can drive a car under it. It's on four big telegraph pole type.
You can drive under
instructions.
It.
Yeah.
So it's a big plane.
Yeah. It's
when you said built a plane, I was expecting like a little Cessna or a glider or something.
And you have to climb a ladder to get up into it, into the, you know, the cockpit. And it's the shape of, I don't know if people remember, a short sky van. It's a bit like that. It may be a bit bigger than
That's
a short
a boxer
sky van.
And
they used to fly, but yeah, boxy.
Boxy, yeah.
So he's got this plane. It's made out of, it's a bits of metal and van and corrugated iron. You know, it's got the front, the fuselage, the tail. What it doesn't have are any wings. So it's a plane minus the wings, and it's got, I think it's called Indaba or Indobo Airways, something like that. So he lives in it, and it's specially climate controlled. So in the summer, when it's really hot outside, it's really, really hot inside. And when it's cold outside, it's really, really cold inside. And he lives in it, and he makes miniature planes. So he makes model planes from oil cans. And
while living inside a fake plane.
Yeah, that he built. So everyone else in the area is living in rondavels. So they've got circular clay houses with kind of grass roofs.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's living in this kind of monstrous plane without wings. It's really impressive.
But it is. I mean, but I was thinking to myself, if I was going to build something to live inside in the African sun,
and
would I make it
too.
Out of metal?
Well, it's certainly distinctive.
It's not a plane, is it? It's an oven.
It's an oven, yeah. It's like Heath Robinson meets Blade Runner or maybe Wallace and Gromit.
Good Lord. As we're coming towards the end of the podcast, there's one more thing I wanted to show off.
Uh-huh.
And it's not particularly about books, although it still concerns words. And that is that David also started something a few years ago, which is the most tremendous fun. Have you seen the film The Wicker Man?
Have I seen the film The Wicker Man? Of course I have.
Yes. Well, David does something quite weird with it.
Every now and again, these things happen in life, don't they? Where you have an idea for something and you think it's going to be a one-off and you don't put any effort into it, and yet it seems to have created a life of its own, and it just demands to be out there in the world. And that was Sing Along Wicker Man. I have a friend, Eliza, and we've been playing in a band together for many years, and we both loved the music from The Wicker Man. And our friend Jane Bombain, who runs a restaurant and venue in Brighton, said, "Would the two of you like to come and do something one May?" And I said to Eliza, "Why don't we do that thing? Why don't we do that thing of playing some songs from The Wicker Man?" And then I said to her, "You know what? I said, I'm sure a few months ago in London, I saw a poster for Sing Along a Wicker Man. I remember thinking what a brilliant idea it was." And she said, "Oh my God, yeah." And so I Googled it and nothing. I couldn't find any mention of it. And I never have since. I think I imagined it. No one has ever come to me and said, "You nicked our idea." I don't think it ever existed. And so we put it together, and with a sort of DIY Vic and Bob aesthetic to it. So we hold up boards with the instructions written in marker pen, and we give the audience goodie bags which contain edible foreskins, edible umbilical cords, edible frogs, and lolly sticks for making crucifixes, and pagan hymn books with all of the lyrics to the songs. I love doing it. I love doing it. It's an odd one though, because you are goading the audience from the beginning into taking the sides, the side of the villagers, which everyone willingly does. And the film builds its momentum, and the songs grow, and you've got that final scene where they're all singing "Summer is a coming in," and then we all collectively burn a man to death. And it's been parodied by League of Gentlemen and others. Oh, God, Jesus Christ, oh, God. And yet, at that point in the film, my blood turns to ice, because I have been complicit in a small way in creating that, causing that. It's just a film, it's just a bit of fun, but it's that one bit where the one bit is the key bit, but where it all changes, and all of a sudden you go, oh, I feel dirty. And then when the film ends, I put a wicker paper basket on my head with little slots for my eyes, and I salute the audience and walk off, and yet a part of me dies every night when that happens. But it was waiting to happen, Sing Along Wicker Man. We've toured it all over the UK. We've done it with Robin Hardy, the film director, before he died, on several occasions. And with his family as well, he'd bring his family along, that'll join in with the actions. We did it in the Ellen Gallen Hotel, which was the original bar where the various pub scenes in The Green Man were filmed. We've been over to Belfast twice to do it for different festivals over there. It's the only time I've ever felt threatened, or been threatened, where somebody in the audience afterwards took offence to our taking the mickey out of the taking of the sacrament, where we encourage the audience to feed Smarties to each other. And a guy was asking afterwards, really drunk, really tall guy, probably in his 50s, 60s, was saying, "You need to take that out. You need to take that out. That's blasphemous, that is." And I was going, "Yeah, whatever." And I swear he uttered the words, "Oh, you've killed a man." And I went, "We'll take it out. We'll take it." Other than that, we've had no comeback.
I think I told you the story before. The very first time I went to the Outer Hebrides, I was still a police officer at the time, and I got asked to go out. I was doing some work for the Scottish Parliament, and I got flown out to Stornoway on November the 5th, expecting to see lots of fireworks, and there's nothing, and I suddenly realised it's a Sunday. And, of course, they're very strongly Presbyterian. Mm. And a bunch of ministers linked arms across the runway to try and stop us landing. No. But yeah, they eventually moved out of the way and we landed. But I said to them, it was sort of wintertime, you know, it's November the 5th, and it got dark very early in the afternoon because you're that far north. And the leader of the council at the time, I said, it's a shame, really. I'm only here for a few days. It would have been nice to see Callanish, you know, the big stone circle and the black houses and that sort of thing. He says, I'll take you out there tonight if you like. And it was really weird because we're driving on these unlit roads, no street lighting at all, and it was a full moon. And it was a full moon. We're driving on this Land Rover, and we suddenly arrive at Callanish, and it just felt very ancient and very old. And I felt very suddenly alone. I'm here with this man, and there's a couple of other villagers around Callanish at moonlight. And I thought, and I'm a mainland police officer. You know, I did kind of start looking for the Wicker Man. You know. It was, but they couldn't have been nicer. And I went back there again last summer, and it's weird to see it in daylight. It seems so much smaller. Seeing it by moonlight in the night, in the darkness, it just felt huge, almost cathedral-like, because it's a big stone circle.
That is really funny. I love it that you're teed up with the whole Wicker Man thing, and then you're off on this wee island, and you suddenly think, oh no, I know what's going to happen.
I know, it was so
And there was
weird.
Nobody for you to shag.
No Britt Eklund.
No Britt Eklund, although perhaps, okay, if you had lost your virginity by then, sorry, if anyone hasn't seen it, spoiler.
I just spoiled it now.
So luckily enough, you had sex by that point, so you thought, well.
Oh, yes.
If the same rules apply.
Loads and loads of times.
Okay, you so know, you felt.
Yeah, I was filthy and dirty and not worthy of a sacrifice, thankfully.
Okay, but
that's an extraordinary moment where that thought just went through my head as I'm standing there, because it's sort of.
Yeah, when it's too
in
late.
In the middle of nowhere and full moon and the stones are all lit up. And
you think, I should have thought of this before I got in the
plane.
Yeah,
I know. It was a. But yeah, quite an adventure.
That reminds me, did I mention to you that I had been to hell and back?
What, recently?
I've been to hell and back. In fact, I was kicked out of hell. Hell is a little place in Poland.
Oh, okay.
A little town on the hell.
Well, I didn't
peninsula.
Think you'd really gone to Hades.
Yeah. You know? Oh, yeah. So, but anyway, the police kicked me out. There was a coup on in Russia at the time, and they're all very sensitive. I had to leave town. But it reminded me of entrances to the underworld. So I have an idea that maybe there are seven of them, maybe in kind of Christian mythology anyway. One of them is in Warsaw, inside the royal palace. There's a particular corner, and I suppose if you broke through the wall, there's a tunnel down to the underworld. One of them is in Ireland, on a kind of an island that Catholics go to, and they fast and they kind of walk around sometimes in bare feet on little beds of stone. So the island that's in the middle of Loch Derg, and there's a little cave there, and that's one of the entrances to the underworld, and there's some others, I can't remember where they are. But I'm thinking, how weird, because it's, you know, a metaphysical place, but actually it has some entrances.
Absolutely.
That's probably how Mr. Ben works. You know, he goes to the shop. Goes into the changing room, goes out the different door. Whoa, he's in the underworld. That's what that was all about, actually.
But that looks like the underworld is going to be really good fun, because you get to dress up as an astronaut or a cowboy. Well, I suppose we ought to think about wrapping up. Yeah.
We should be thanking some people. You may have heard somebody breathing in the background. It's our esteemed sound engineer, Raphael Darley. And we should also thank our sponsor, Cardora.
Indeed.
Who had their official party the other day to launch.
Yes, I couldn't make it. I was away.
I was out. It was cool.
Was it good?
There were some very nice buns. And some cakes, too.
Ha ha ha. Did you do any bun reading?
Indeed. Because if I'd done bun reading, I would be out. Oops! Almost gave it away. Now, what are we going to say about Cardora? Because some people might think, what is Cardora?
Well, we know what Cardora is. Cardora is a company that allows you to create short videos, short personal videos that you can send as greetings cards.
They're kind of like personalised movie greetings cards by email, which are completely free. And if you just Google Cardora, C-A-R-D-O-R-A, Cardora, I think it's cardora.co.
.co.
.co.
Cardora. There's no M on the end.
Yeah.
We haven't got an apostrophe, they haven't got an M.
Yeah, I know. Cardora.co is their website, which is very good. So I recommend you check them out.
And of course, music by Sam Rhodes.
And just to remind you of the competition, what's the official term, or what do you think should be the official term for a bum reader? Someone who reads bums.
Something that Jackie Stallone is apparently very good at.
Mm-hmm.
And
so we look forward to hearing your answers and to our next episode. But in the meantime, I've been Paul Waters.
And I've been Stephen Colgan.
We're going to end appropriately with a song by David Bramwell's band, Oddfellows Casino, which features the voice of writer Alan Moore. So we'll see you soon.
Thank you, and goodbye.
Bye.